This is February 4th, 2018. And I'm going to talk about willpower and exertion today. This is right at front center of my mind because we're in the middle of a term intensive, our winter, 5-week winter in term intensive. I'm replying to out-of-town participants' weekly reports on how they managed their commitments, and from some, I don't know, 30 people or something like that. And so hopefully some of this will encourage people, not just people in term intensive, but anyone to keep going in practice. I have several articles I'm going to read parts of. I'll start off with a 2015 article from Scientific American called Conquer Yourself, Conquer the World. Self-control is not just a puritanical virtue. It is a key psychological trait that breeds success at work and play and in overcoming life's hardships. And this is by a Roy Baumeister. For whom there seems to be no word here about who he is. So I'll just read his opening paragraph. The ability to regulate our impulses and desires is indispensable to success in living and working with others. People with good control over their thought processes, emotions, and behaviors not only flourish in school and in their jobs, but are also healthier, wealthier, and more popular. And they have better intimate relationships, as their partners confirm, and are more trusted by others. What is more, they are less likely to go astray by getting arrested, becoming addicted to drugs, or experiencing unplanned pregnancies. They even live longer. Brazilian writer Paulo Coelho summed up these benefits in one of his novels. If you conquer yourself, then you will conquer the world. And in a way, that's one way to understand spiritual practice, is conquering oneself, one's weaknesses. Maybe the Buddha, in some early texts, the Buddha said defeating an army of 100 men alone, single-handedly, is nothing compared to the challenge of defeating the mind or managing the mind. So much of this article is a review of research into willpower. And oh, here's the bit on this. Roy Baumeister is a social psychologist with research interests that range from social rejection to sexuality and aggression. He is a professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University. Much of this article is where he just chronicles the research into these things and very, very generously acknowledges where his own earlier research was flawed and how it's others after him have built on his research. But he starts by saying, self-control is another name for changing ourselves. That's a nice way to put it, because control is a double-edged sword. The more attached we are to control, the more neurotic we're likely to be. So control in itself isn't just a pure virtue, but it certainly is when it comes to managing our appetites, our cravings, and things like that. So it just depends on how you look at control. Self-control is another name for changing ourselves, and it is by far the most critical way we have of adapting to our environment. It's another nice way to look at it, adapting to our environment. You could say that really the essence of intelligence, from an evolutionary point of view, is the ability to adapt. And that's another way to understand the benefits of Zen meditation is by becoming less attached to our ideas about things, we become better able to adapt. Indeed, the desire to control ourselves and our environment is deeply rooted in the psyche and underlies human engagement in science, politics, business, and the arts. Given that most of us lack the kingly power to command others to do our bidding, and that we need to enlist the cooperation of others to survive, the ability to restrain aggression, greed, and sexual impulses becomes a necessity. And then he mentions this famous study that came to be called the Marshmallow Test. If those of you who haven't heard of it, it's very influential in the 1960s, where children in a study, children were offered a choice between immediately getting the candy, or else receiving a couple of those same sweets if they could only wait for a little while. So it's about delay of gratification, the ability to delay gratification, self-control. More than a decade after these early experiments were published, the guys who did this tracked down the children, by then young adults, and did so again as they entered middle age. The ones who had the most success at resisting temptation at age 4 went on to be the most successful as adults. Skipping some paragraphs here because this is a pretty long article. He says, I have spent a quarter of a century doing laboratory studies on self-control with an endlessly fascinating stream of creative colleagues. Over that time, I have come to the conclusion that self-control, which might also be referred to as self-regulation or willpower, works something like a muscle does. In particular, it seems to tire after a workout. Several hundred studies in many labs have now replicated the basic finding that after exerting willpower, people have less left over to complete a second chore. In one early study, we found that people who called on their self-control to resist chocolates and cookies later showed less fortitude on a difficult problem-solving exercise. They gave up much more easily than people who had not worked their willpower muscle. In other studies, trying to suppress a forbidden thought, such as being told not to think of a white bear, that's the one what they use in their study, made participants less able to control subsequent emotional reactions. We coined the term ego depletion to label the state of diminished willpower that follows from expending psychic energy on self-control, whether it's resisting temptation or forcing oneself to make tough decisions. So here, and this is right in the wheelhouse of the term intensive, is our wish to refrain from doing things we know don't serve us, be able to follow through on changing ourselves, our behavior, in ways that we know will be good for us and for others. Both of them require this willpower. Ego depletion, from a Zen perspective, it sounds great. Who wouldn't want that? But from a psychological point of view, it's more a little more complicated. Ego is used in differently than it's often used in Zen. Ego can mean our ability to cope, to function in life. Another Buddhist teacher, Joseph Goldstein, said he thinks of ego as people with strong ego as people with strong minds. And I think it's good to have this other understanding of ego. So, as I just said, I think last week in Taisho, it's so easy to make such a thing out of the ego when actually there's nothing there. It's just a certain force of mind that can cut either way, can be useful or harmful to us. So ego depletion, this means diminished willpower. And then he mentions two other lines of research that have extended the muscle analogy. One that showed that that after exertion, willpower has not entirely vanished. Rather, the body seems to be conserving energy. So if an important challenge or opportunity arises, more self-control can be tapped. This finding parallels what happens with physical muscles. As muscles begin to tire, athletes cut back on exertion to conserve remaining energy and strength, but they can marshal concerted effort if needed, calling on reserves for a sprint to the finish. Now here's the really encouraging thing in terms of our exerting ourselves in Zen practice. Muscles do not just become fatigued, they increase in strength when used regularly. Self-control can also strengthen with practice, as shown when people go through an exercise program to enhance it. And he mentions a study, too much detail to get into here. He says it has occurred to us from these studies that the Victorian notion of building character seems to have some scientific validity. Exerting self-control on a regular basis appears to build up a person's capacity to call on more of this character trait in a pinch. When we did these studies, we began to ask ourselves whether actual physical energy was getting used up, or whether the notion of energy consumption was just a psychological metaphor. And then an answer to this came when they another line of research showed that that glucose diminished through willpower. They found that a dose of glucose administered just before self-control is beginning to flag helps to restore the needed willpower to press ahead. These results strongly suggest that willpower is indeed more than a metaphor. So, just to back up here in terms of practice, yes, this confirms that we can't go at peak intensity without breaks. In Sesshin, which is the most demanding form of practice, we do have breaks, and people can sleep at night. But the takeaway, I think, is this ability we have to develop, like a muscle, develop our willpower and our self-control. Skipping a few paragraphs here, he says, self-control can be maintained, but not indefinitely. After all, you do not get an infusion of glucose because you think willpower is unlimited or because you have been promoted to a managerial role. You just become more willing to spend from your reserves. Eventually, a limit is reached. The illusion of endless self-control is tantamount to believing that a bank account has infinite funds. At the beginning, you may spend freely, but ultimately, you seriously risk running out of money. This is also reminds us of how important it is in any kind of exertion, term intensive or any other kind of exertion, to be realistic about what you're trying to do and not to extend yourself beyond what your capacity is. The reasons that term intensive can be work so well and why it's become so popular is that it's just for 5 weeks. In the fall, the one we do in the fall is just 3 weeks, but for that limited period of time, we can push ourselves. We can persevere in a way that we wouldn't be able to, you know, indefinitely. Another thing that is so important about the term intensive is the matter of accountability. It's one thing to resolve to do this or that or to refrain from doing this or that for 5 weeks or 3 weeks, but then to have to report each week on how to others on how well one managed is the key part of it. That's why one's commitments in for those 5 weeks or three, one's commitments need to be specific enough that there is accountability. If it's just a resolve to try harder to sit in the morning, what is that? That's pretty mushy. We need to be specific about things to have it most effective. There's a an article here I fished out of my files from the New York Times, no date, but it's called My Adventures in Accountability. It made me think of the term intensive. And this is by a Mary Laura Philpott. She's the author and illustrator of Penguins with People Problems. And she says, I stood in the middle of a forest and whisper screamed a word that cannot be printed in this newspaper. For the second time in one morning, I was on a wooded park trail. The first time, I decided to cram in a mini hike before doing an hour of writing and then heading to a meeting for my job. Then I got home, checked my pockets, and found that my driver's license had gone missing. So back I went, hiking the same route a second time, eyes scanning the ground for my lost card. An hour later, there I was under the tree, still no license, my precious hour of writing time gone. This is what I get for trying to exercise, I thought. Later, I ate a packet of gummy fruit snacks in my car on the way to my meeting. There's that ego depletion.
Glucose.
Yeah, glucose, right. She didn't know how wise she was when she was doing that. I reported this episode to my various accountability groups, sets of friends who check in on a daily or weekly basis to hold one another's feet to the fire of various goals. There's the fitness group. I'm supposed to check in with those friends weekly about how many days I've worked out. There's the healthy eating group, in which we keep a text thread circulating to log accomplishments such as drank green juice instead of Diet Coke. Then there's the writing group, five nonfiction writers who also have day jobs. We meet weekly before work and use a private Facebook page to hold one another to our pledge not to let our creative endeavors get pushed aside. Accountability is all the rage, and not just in our own lives. Whenever something bad happens, people insist on finding someone to hold accountable, as if that would undo anything. It's a buzzword in the business and political worlds, code for responsibility, and the buck stops here. Being accountable means you reply promptly to emails at work. I don't buy that. One of the articles I didn't read 2 weeks ago about the growing awareness of the dark side of social media and digital devices is the one that talks about how this new expectation that anything that flits through your mind that you want to email someone that you should get a reply. Or of course it's the same with texting. But who made that up? It's especially if you have a heavy load of email, you just have to decide what you have time for and what you don't, and when you can get to it, if at all. So I just reject that just because someone sends me an email, I have to reply to it at all, much less promptly. There. Remember that. I'm trying to convince myself because I like replying to emails when I have the time. It means you submit your actions to checks and balances, especially if you're president. It means being watched as you spend money. It means every move you make counts towards something. Personally, I'm glad I'm not an elected official or chief executive because I can't take any more accountability. I've brought it on myself, of course, but the more people and forces I have to answer to, the more held accountable starts to feel like held underwater. Some days I want to spend an afternoon online looking at pictures of dogs with eyebrows, and I don't want to have to report it to anyone. Some nights I want to spend $9.99 to buy a movie on demand, even though I could wait a week and rent it for $2.99, and I want to revel in that foolish splurge by myself. And let me just say, this is the kind of thing we can laugh about with ourselves and not make into a big moral issue. This is where we have to acknowledge our limits and give ourselves some metaphorical glucose to the service of our larger aspirations. As it is, I find I can clear the bar for only one accountability group at a time. Let me just say that I've always seen and will always see increased sitting as the core of term intensive, because everything comes out of sitting. Upholding the precepts, repentance, giving, the ability to give, generosity, countless good deeds, the way of right living, all come from Zazen. That should be the core of it. That's the root. All the rest, whatever other pledges one makes in term intensive, are the leaves and branches. As an approval-seeking person, I always want a gold star, but to achieve one thing generally means letting go of another. I can write, but only, as they say, by putting my butt in the chair. If my butt is in the chair, my butt is not outside walking. I skip checking in with my hiking buddies on those days, but not because I want to hide from them. It's just that I'm already a little downtrodden from having to report to my healthy eating group. And she says, in quotations, unwrapped 7 slices of American cheese for lunch. So I play a shell game of approval. Today my writing group won't be proud of me, but my healthy living group will. Tomorrow I will admit to eating a bowl of my kids' sugary cereal for breakfast, but I will also gloat over having pushed the bowl aside when I finished and stayed in that seat, building and demolishing and rebuilding paragraphs for 3 hours. Speaking of my kids, I'm not in any accountability groups for parenting. Children hold you accountable on their own. They keep a tally and they remind you. Hey, Mom, this is the third day we've had sandwiches for dinner. Hey, Mom, we were late for carpool yesterday and the day before. And this one, always leveled half accusingly, half compassionately. Hey, Mom, your eyes are red. Did you cry? There's no dodging these little accountability officers. As if kids in accountability groups weren't oversight enough, there are always Facebook and Instagram to help you feel the duty to measure up. Everything online is quantified, tallied up in hearts and upturned thumbs. If a woman posts a picture of the sparkling sunrise over her morning yoga session, she's publicly delivering on her commitment to meditative stretching. And then she gives other examples. Sometimes I feel ill-equipped to do all this accounting. There are days, even weeks, that I don't check in with my groups, even though, of course, I have voluntarily joined them. I pull back when I feel the tail is wagging the dog, that I'm putting more energy into my anxiety over reporting what I've done than I would have put into simply doing it. Ultimately, accountability is optional. I could leave my groups and cut myself loose from the commitment to document how I use my time, but I'm self-aware enough to realize I need that sense of obligation. Knowing someone's going to ask whether I met my goals has often made me get up and do what I might otherwise have blown off. I read that a lot in these term-intensive reports. And I have better health, more pages written, and, yes, greater happiness to show for it. The encouragement helps, too. When I lost my writing time, but doubled my exercise, that morning in the park, my friends offered commiseration and congratulations. That's another reason I won't quit. I feel too keenly the need to use my minutes wisely. They're going by much too fast. And speaking of using minutes wisely, I fished out another article here, Yellow, from Age. Actually never out of date, is about the habit of running late. Because that's another thing. I know I can certainly speak from experience, the tendency to cut things too closely, getting somewhere. I don't know if anyone in their term-intensive commitment has made that one of the commitments, but doesn't matter. That's something those of us with a problem like that can always start and try to improve on. It's a review of a book called Never Be Late Again, Seven Cures for the Punctually Challenged by Diana DeLonzor. And the name of the article is Running Late, ... Again. The author of the review, Kay Harvey, quotes this other author, DeLonzor, saying, "Telling a chronically late person to be on time is like telling an overweight person not to eat so much." To break the pattern, she said, late people must identify the psychological forces that underlie their habit and reprogram the ways they think. DeLonzor says that there's a mix of subconscious behaviors that puts people behind, and she puts offenders in seven categories: rationalizers, producers, deadliners, indulgers, absent-minded professors, evaders, and rebels. So, in hopes that this could be useful in terms of identifying this, the indulger is one who plays things by ear rather than sticking to a schedule. A deadliner needs a crisis to get motivated. An evader denies her anxiety while trying three shades of eyeliner. Most people are unaware of the feelings and habits that surround their lateness, Delanzor says. Ask yourself why you're doing this. I got to that point years ago where I just had to stop and really examine why I have to cut things so close in getting places. And there were some useful insights, and I made some improvement. I'm still working on it. The producers are overbooked. Some late people can benefit from timing how long it takes to do something or to get somewhere. Too often, their concept is based on that one time 10 years ago when all the lights were green, Delanzor said. And then there's also evidence that some late people perceive time differently from punctual people. And then just to finish those seven categories, there's the rebel, one who perceives society's rules as too ordinary. The absent-minded professor, who easily gets preoccupied. And the rationalizer, who sees his view of the world as the true one, no matter what. Absent-minded professor, I missed a flight not that long ago because I was so absorbed in a book in an airport bookstore. So that would be an upward interpretation of that, is when you're just so concentrated. And that also points to the difference between concentration and mindfulness. Concentration means that, yeah, you forget about time. You're so absorbed. But mindfulness needs to also work for us in daily life. That's where you maintain this wider awareness of time and space. Just to finish this little article, a few things to break the lateness habit. Consciously change your ideas about punctuality. Acknowledge that lateness is a big deal. Yeah, that's I do think that's very important. It's inconsiderate to others when you're late. Think of others. Second thing, change your thinking about trying to arrive exactly on time. Plan to arrive early. Figure out what you're doing that's making you late. Ask yourself what you can do differently. That's something that I've had some success with, is after many failures, is realizing that the things I have to do, among the things I expect to do before leaving, I have to start with the things I have to do, the necessary things, and then if there's time. It's so obvious, of course, but it's not so easy to implement through habit, in the face of habit. So do the necessary things first. And then, if there's time, do the other things you'd like to do. Question your urge to take on that extra task that appears. Ask yourself, do I need to do this now? Will it help get me where I'm going? That's sort of what I just mentioned. Next, focus on the great feeling you'll have when you walk into your workplace, meeting, or appointment on time, capable and together. And then finally, expect more of yourself. Do what's right, even if it's not easy. And then the last article I want to read a little from is from a Tricycle Magazine fall of 2014. Tricycle is a national Buddhist review, published quarterly. And this article is called Brain Karma. Is Delusion Hardwired? And this also, this speaks more from the biological perspective of change, of how we can change ourselves through practice, Zen practice or any kind of practice. How do you get to Carnegie Hall? She's her name is Wendy Hasenkamp. She's a has a PhD in .. Well, don't know, it just says PhD. Serves as a senior scientific officer at the Mind and Life Institute. Her research examines the neural correlates of attention and mind wandering during meditation. Well, I've spoken so often of karma in Taisho. Karma, at its simplest, just means action. Action and reaction. Another way to understand it is habit force, tendencies, dispositions. And really, this is our work. This is a work of a lifetime. This is work of many lifetimes of purifying our karma, overcoming our habit forces that cause suffering to other people and to ourselves. She says, these ancient ideas about karma are mirrored with surprising detail in the foundations of modern neuroscience. One of the most fundamental principles of neuroscience is known as Hebb's Law, H-E-B-B. Hebb's Law, also called cell assembly theory. In his 1949 book, The Organization of Behavior, the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb laid out a principle that is often summarized by the phrase, neurons that fire together, wire together. In his work, Hebb proposed that any two cells or systems of cells that are repeatedly active at the same time will tend to become associated, so that activity in one facilitates activity in the other. This is the basic premise of neural plasticity, the ability of the brain to change through experience. Here too, this is the great, great hope, great encouragement of our work to change ourselves, is neuroplasticity. The mechanisms of neuroplasticity are being revealed through an ever-increasing and nuanced body of research showing how our brain networks are physically created and updated on a micro level. Imagine two neurons connected such that activity in the first neuron makes the second one more likely to fire. If we repeatedly stimulate the two neurons simultaneously, after a few hours, the same initial stimulation of the first neuron will lead to a larger electrical response in the second neuron, a change due in part to the release of more chemical neurotransmitters, and so forth. She says it is not difficult to see how these findings relate to the idea of karma. What's essential in this process is that each of our experiences, thoughts and ideas, emotions, sensations, behavior in the world is reflected at a cellular level. Millions of neurons come alive in a complicated network of activity that underlies each experience. And to the extent that these specific patterns of activity are repeated, the neural connections are facilitated, the mental grooves deepen. As a result, engaging in any particular thought or behavior, not just behavior, thought, any particular thought or behavior will make us more likely to engage in the same action in the future, as every act reinforces the neural connections that are associated with it. When I read this, I thought of Dogen's famous words. He said, exertion is not something that people of the world naturally love, but it is the last refuge of all. This is the work of persevering in the face of resistance, in the face of our habit forces, persevering. This is how we change. And then she just says, where does this leave us? Are we doomed to play out our lives at the mercy of our habitual neural patterns? Well, we know that's the answer to that, no. Both Buddhism and modern neuroscience say no. In fact, the neuroplastic capacities of the brain that contribute to our karmic limitations become the same ones that hold the key to our liberation. For centuries, the experiences of contemplative practitioners have shown that transformation is possible. More recently, neuroscience, in part because of its engagement with Buddhism, has discovered a previously unknown potential for brain plasticity throughout one's life. This is the good news. With repeated practice, the brain can be changed, and to a surprising degree. Indeed, because neuroplasticity is always operative, the brain is continuously being rewired based on our experiences. The key is to put some conscious intention into what those experiences are. All right, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to the brute dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain.